You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey guys, Nick's here to make a special announcement for Myopia Defend Your Childhood. The month of April is going to be a Public Defender Month, which we haven't done in years, but our listenership has grown and I've been getting all sorts of recommendations over Twitter. So here's what you're going to do. If you have a movie to suggest starting February 1st and ending on February the 14th, we are going to open the phone lines, open Twitter, open our email to you making recommendations. If you want to call in and leave a voicemail, the number is 770-835-5578. That's 770-835-5578. If you want to email us, go to myopiapodcast@gmail.com or on Twitter at myopiapodcast and tell us a little bit. Tell us what movie you want to do. Tell us why you think it'd make a good episode. Tell us a little bit about your memories of it, perhaps. And if you get selected, the month of April will be dedicated to you, our fans, defending the movies you grew up. How will you stand when we put a piece of your past on trial? Thanks, guys.
Good evening and welcome to Disremembered, the stories behind your childhood. This season, we're continuing our series on the Disney Renaissance. I'm Daniel. I am the host of Disremembered, a frequent contributor to Myopia Defend Your Childhood, and Popdose. On joining me tonight are...
Hi, this is Nick Hoffman, host of Myopia Defend Your Childhood. I guess I'm a riffer on Cineprov, and I'm the editor of Do Letter Podcasting.
And I'm John. I'm the host of Mission Briefing James Bond Podcast, part of the Myopia Network, and I'm just glad to be here.
All right. Well, thank you both for joining me once again as we prattle on about all of the backstabbing at the Disney corporate offices. Last week, if you'll remember, we ended on a sad note with company president Frank Wells dying in a helicopter crash during a ski trip. It was a huge monumental blow for Disney's upper management, and it also left open the question of who would replace him. Considering all of the success that he had had in their animation and film division, Jeffrey Katzenberg fully expected to take Wells' place. But Eisner announced that he would be taking over all of Wells' responsibilities and never consulted with Katzenberg on that decision.
Wow. And thus the 90s were born.
The mid-90s, yes. Katzenberg, of course, did not take this lightly. He took his grievances mostly to the public, because he had gained a lot of public goodwill. After all, he was the one who was being touted in the press as the savior of Disney's animated films, and we've discussed why in previous episodes.
So, what was Eisner's, like, was this like a game plan of his, like a Game of Thrones type thing, or did he had the right people in the right place, or did he have an actual... bona fides to get in there?
You mean in terms of taking over Wells's position?
Yeah.
Excellent question. Really, he just never discussed his rationale with Katzenberg, and I think the idea was actually Katzenberg was starting to expect some contractual bonus payments that were due to him at the time because the Disney's films had been so successful, so he needed to have some of those net grosses coming to him. But Eisner and the rest of the upper management were dragging their feet on paying Katzenberg, so he was already getting a little upset about that. And that battle just spilled over into this decision.
It's funny how it happens that a lot of Disney's biggest rivals seem to come out of inside Disney who were wronged. I mean, look at Bluth.
And we'll get into what that means for Katzenberg in a second. But the other one of the big problems, though, is that Katzenberg also had no supporters on the Disney board of directors. In particular, our old friend Roy Disney was upset that in the press, Katzenberg was getting all the credit for reviving the Disney animated features, which, as you'll recall, were near and dear to Roy's heart in the first place. Of course, Eisner was dealing with his own problems at the time as well. He had a quadruple bypass surgery in 1994, in the midst of all this.
Quadruple? Man, was he just existing on the McDonald's diet?
A lot of stress to keep one of the biggest companies afloat, would be my guess.
Stress. What does Eisner know about stress?
Well, one thing that Katzenberg did after he left was he started meeting with Steven Spielberg. Some very early meetings, which, if you'll recall, eventually will lead to the founding of DreamWorks.
SKG.
Yes, indeed.
Who's the G in SKG?
David Geffen.
Geffen. Oh, wow. Isn't he a record artist or record producer? The same one who was sent to prison? Or is that a different Geffen?
I thought David Geffen was in prison.
He's the one with the weird hair, right?
Oh, wait, no, you're thinking of... Oh, God, you're not thinking of David Geffen. You're thinking of the guy with the wall of sound who
Phil
shot
Spector
someone.
Phil Spector was the wall of sound guy.
Oh, right, okay, not Geffen. All right, so Geffen of Geffen Records. Okay.
Now, if you'll remember, David Geffen had had a film company in the past that was famous for producing dark-tinged comedies like Beetlejuice. And according to the wiki, he was also a Broadway backer for Cats, so... Okay, and maybe Geffen should have gone to prison, but that's neither here nor there.
Well, whether you like Cats or not, it was still wildly successful.
Yeah.
So he knows how to pick them, at least.
But after those three started meaning to discuss forming a partnership, Spielberg started giving interviews as well, where he criticized Michael Eisner's leadership abilities, which just further upset Eisner. When Katzenberg left, though, he did have a couple of aces left up his sleeve with projects in development, including one that I know everybody's been asking about, The Lion King. The Lion King was originally pitched after Oliver and Company was released and was meant to be a more serious nature documentary style thing. In fact, the original director quit when Disney changed its approach to make it a traditional musical.
So that's where the Disney, the theme park side of things came in, isn't it?
Well, they were talking, my understanding is they were on a flight or something and they were talking about making some sort of Africa-themed musical. I don't know if any of the animal-themed parks were open at that point.
Right. I think Animal Kingdom opened up after Lion King, which would make sense if they wanted Lion King to be more of a documentary-style thing, that they would start thinking about a new theme park.
Yeah.
Right. So, when they were recruiting production staff for this, there was another movie Disney was developing at the time called Pocahontas.
Oh, crap.
Boo.
That movie is so boring.
Animators were given a choice between working on The Lion King or Pocahontas, and because everybody expected Pocahontas to be much more successful, that's what they chose to work on. So, that meant most of the animators in The Lion King were first-timers.
Huh. Weird.
I mean, obviously, hindsight being what it is, I would have thought the opposite would have been true. But yeah,
well, yeah, no.
I guess I kind of the animation of Pocahontas was better than The Lion King.
Well, it's more traditional. Like it's a princess story. Like there's a love interest. I mean, and there is technically one in Lion King. They definitely made it more normal, but or more Disney. But, like, Pocahontas is essentially, like, you could have swapped it out and made it almost anywhere in the world. Like, they didn't care about the history, which is obvious, but it's a very standard story for Disney.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Kind of, for me, it fit under those, the era of Mulan and Hercules, where I was very ambivalent toward Disney's tentpole movies.
Yeah.
You'll note that Mulan and Hercules were released after Katzenberg left the company.
Well, that obviously says a lot about Katzenberg.
There you go. Now, The Lion King was unique in many ways. It was supposedly the first Disney work that wasn't based on a pre-existing material. And I sarcastically threw supposedly in there because...
Because it's Hamlet?
No, not just because of that. When it was in production, many people assumed that it was a remake of an old Japanese TV show called Kimba the White Lion.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Kimba, Simba, yeah. And the animation is very similar for the image of Simba and Kimba.
Originally, Testa, if you look up old test footage, Simba was white.
Wow. Well, it wouldn't be the first time or the last time that Disney played around with anime.
Yeah, I mean, Mulan's very influenced by that style of animation, but the problem is that nobody was really giving the creators of Kimba any credits. In fact, the director claimed he hadn't seen the show before, but he also said that it's possible we were influenced by Kimba, and he can certainly understand if the Kimba creators feel angry if they felt we stole ideas from them.
That's a diplomatic way of saying, yeah, sorry.
Well, it makes you feel bad for the medium-sized properties, right? Like, I'm thinking of, like, Belgian properties that I grew up with that are clearly ripped off by other things. I mean, even as simple as the Snorks versus the Smurfs. But, like, there's a reason why something like that is kind of swept under the rug and saved for, like, novelty YouTube clips where they're like, guess where this came from? Kimba, the White Lion. Where things like Miyazaki, he was a big enough deal that when they tried to rip him off, he could put his foot down. Right?
Because he was already a huge cultural institution in Japan, so the Japanese especially would notice.
Right.
That's, I mean, a huge market to piss off.
Well, and one that they were afraid to. I mean, after Tokyo, or after Euro Disney fails, Tokyo Disney is one of the first ones they try to open because of how big the market is there. The more you're describing this, Daniel, this really does seem like it's mafia phase.
If you said this was in the 60s, I would have believed you.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, power struggles, big guys being pushed aside. I mean, we can get into it later, but like 20th Century Fox being bought out, which was a joke by The Simpsons in this era, because it just seemed like Disney was gobbling everyone up right before their collapse, of course, in the late 90s, which we'll get to, I'm assuming. But, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the thing that's so fascinating about this story. It really is like a mafia story.
Well, didn't South Park do that? It was the mouse owns everything?
If I recall correctly, on South Park, the mouse was an elder god.
I would believe that, yeah.
Yeah.
So the production wasn't smooth either, especially considering that a lot of people were first times. Right as the production was wrapping up, an earthquake hit Los Angeles and forced the studio to shut down, so the film was actually finished in the artists' homes.
Wow. That's cool. How do you finish it back then in an artist's home?
You just do all the drawing there.
Yeah.
Mm. Now, one of the most notable things that everybody remembers of The Lion King are the songs, right? I mean, I don't know offhand how many copies that soundtrack sold, but I remember those songs being everywhere for a while.
They're still everywhere. They're the most memorable part of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Indeed they are. Well, Tim Rice wrote the lyrics, and he was, I think, Andrew Lloyd Webber's old lyricist. I think. He was another Broadway veteran, and Disney was really leaning on those people at the time. And he had agreed to be involved in the project since 1991, but wanted a writing partner. One of the people that he tried to recruit to help him write the songs before he got Elton John to agree to it was ABBA.
Oh, cool. That would have been amazing and trippy as fuck.
Wrong decade. Oh, that's funny, though. I never would have thought of ABBA. You know, it was funny because in the 80s, they tried Billy Joel with that Oliver and Company, and while the music was the best part, it doesn't feel like it fits.
ABBA would have been such a, I think, a similar problem. I don't know.
Yeah, it was definitely not a fit.
Well, I'm just thinking big and sweeping. You know, like, something Sting maybe could have done, but, like, he just doesn't have the vocal, like, the lyrical ballad. I don't know. It's,
yeah. Paul McCartney and Kings.
Yeah. It's just hard to imagine anything without Elton John, because that's, you know, Lion King and Elton John, like, I assume he won an Academy Award for it, but it's just, it's hard to separate those two.
One of the things that's weird to me about the music is how, even just looking back, the people they got were Elton John, and then they tried to go to ABBA, but this is, you know, supposed to be a very heavily influenced African movie, so I've just always wondering, well, now in retrospect, why they didn't go to artists that were influenced by that music? Like, why not get Paul Simon to write Graceland 2, or why not get David Byrne or someone like that?
Didn't they get Paul Simon for someone? For one of them?
Not that I recall.
He would.
I don't know.
Back in the 90s or 80s.
Well, I mean, they did get, what's his name? For Tarzan, Paul. No, Phil Collins.
Phil Collins.
Ugh.
Yeah. If I remember that movie right, the music was the least interesting part of it.
Yeah, we did it for the podcast, and that was a hard one to slog through. That was really rough.
I remember, I think we had to watch that on our own, and I actually fast-forwarded through one of the songs because I just couldn't take it.
Yeah.
Oh, I fast-forwarded through a bit of it, and then I needed to make sure I got the ending, but that one was rough, man. That was really rough.
It was... I think I'd only seen it once before we did the Myopia, and it was passable, but I know my wife just loved that movie, and she was hooked on every second that we watched it. I was not allowed to fast forward through it.
And I mean, knowing her, that would have been enforced.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. She wears the pants in this relationship. I understand that.
That's funny.
All right, so... As said, this was the film that everybody expected to fail, but it didn't fail. In fact, it became the second highest grossing film of all time, not adjusted for inflation. And before you ask, the first highest was Jurassic Park.
Really? Of all time or of that year?
Of all time.
Wow, really? Jurassic Park, not Titanic or Star Wars.
This was released in 1994, so at the time, Jurassic Park was still number one. And then I think Titanic got released in 97, and that's what dethroned it, even though that movie's so much worse than Jurassic Park.
Well, it plays to its demographic.
People who can sit for 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
Now, the big contrast, which we referenced earlier, was how Pocahontas was in production at the same time, and that was meant to be Disney's big traditional romantic epic.
But?
But it only grossed $68 million domestically.
Does that count as a failure for Disney?
Considering that their previous thing was the second highest grossing movie of all time, people noticed.
Yeah, really. It wasn't a good movie. It wasn't, in any way.
Well, I mean, it's also so much smaller in scope. Like, it just feels kind of like a damp fart. I don't know, it just... Pocahontas isn't bad. I rewatched it recently because my toddler likes colors. But it just... so little happens, and it's such a cliche movie compared to what was starting to come out in the same era. That it just, it to me, when it came out, was just kind of a disappointment, you know?
And to the point that we made earlier, Lion King kind of cribs off Hamlet, which is a story that's been told millions of times for hundreds of years, and Pocahontas is really just a remake of what? Like, Snow White? It's a princess and her boyfriend.
It's kind of a remake of Fern Gully, but told through bullshit U.S. history.
Well, yeah, there was nothing accurate about that at all.
Yeah.
No.
To be fair, they did experiment with a not-white princess.
Well, I mean, and the thing is, there's nothing, I don't even know, like, the history isn't even what bothers me. It's that it gets on this high horse for no reason about something that it gets wrong. Like, if it didn't have such an axe to grind, it wouldn't bother me as much. Right? It's just like Hunchback of Notre Dame. isn't that bad. It's not that good, but it's not that bad. They get history stuff wrong, but it's not the history stuff that they're harping on. You know, like...
Well, I think the main problem with Hunchback of Notre Dame was the fact that they changed so much of the original novel around up to and including ruining the ending. Where it's like, I get that there's changes, but, you know, Les Mis had been already been around for 10 years, and that was a musical adaptation of a Victor Hugo novel that kept everything intact, so it could be done.
Well, exactly, and, I mean, a lot of the other Disney movies, you could argue, they're folklore, so there are different versions of them anyway, but when it's a set novel, and you're changing it to Disney-fy it, that's got some issues to it.
Now, going back to its background, Katzenberg was around when that was starting development, and he signed off on it specifically because Beauty and the Beast didn't win the Best Picture Oscar. He thought that another epic romance would get another Best Picture Oscar nomination for Disney.
He's not wrong.
Yeah.
Well, in this case...
In this case, yes, but in theory, he's not wrong.
Now, it faced a lot of criticism at the time, and Nick was right, about botching the history and for sanitizing the story of the actual people. Pocahontas
was... Well, the sequel was even worse. God damn. Jesus Christ.
Well, this film, Pocahontas was criticized for being a sort of La Malinche figure. I probably bungled that pronunciation, but it's like, oh, I remember that from college. I better use that. For those who don't know, La Malinche was famous as one of the original First Nationers who helped Cortez conquer the Aztec Empire.
So Malinche was from a neighboring tribe. There's rumor that they were lovers, even. But she actually helped, because everyone knows that Cortez had like 5,000 armed men. But he also, not unlike the 300, had... thousands of others from surrounding, city-states, all of which hated the Aztecs because the Aztecs were cruel and violent and sacrificed their children. So Malinche thought that they had found an ally, which, frankly, Pocahontas had done, Powhatan had as well. And so it's kind of like calling a Native American like an Uncle Tom, someone who helps the enemy. Even though in the real history, Pocahontas was 14, and was actually traded to John Rolfe as a wife as part of a peace treaty for the Second Powhatan War.
Right, and then she went back to England and ended up dying very young from because her immune system couldn't handle the European diseases.
And I've eaten British food, and that doesn't help anything.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, you're welcome. And further, of course, she apparently sent messages home, because you can imagine if you're a native living in, you know, kind of wooden huts, and then going to London, which at the time was the world's largest city with a population of 1.1 million, you would say, maybe don't try to destroy these people. They have London.
Yeah. Now, one of the best parts about that sequel, and I know we're getting kind of off track, was, I guess, her protector, a big warrior, he was told by the chief, make a notch in your staff for each person you see.
Yeah.
So that we know what we're up against. And throughout the, I guess, opening montage of where she sees London, he's just notching away until there's nothing left of this staff, and he just throws it away.
Yeah.
It's
well done.
Part of saying, you guys are outmatched in every way. Just don't even try.
Yeah. And I mean, like, that's kind of the thing that's interesting about Pocahontas as a story that they did, which is, you know, when I used to teach the Cold War, I guess I still teach the Cold War. When I teach the Cold War, what Disney was really good at doing is saying, you know, all the world's cultures were all part of the same story. And so this is, you know, a British story. This is a French story. This is a Scandinavian story. You know, this is a German story from the Brothers Grimm to Hans Christian Andersen. And they all belong together. We're a Western culture. And so this was the first kind of American princess, right, like Daniel referenced. And so that part I get, you know, just like a couple years later, we'd have a Japanese princess with Mulan, which is also kind of a neat twist to it.
Chinese, but, right?
Yeah. Oh, yes, you're correct. I'm sorry. No, I mean, you're right. I just, whatever. George Takei's in it, so I always think Japan first.
Oh my.
Is he really? Who is he?
He is the head of the elders, the ones that bring what's his name back to life. Eddie Murphy's character.
Oh yeah.
Oh, cool.
Anywho's it's but yeah, so it's just kind of interesting to think about that they were just broadening the net. And this is also Mel Gibson's kind of foray into Disney as well. Yeah. And he would remake the movie in his own way in a few years with Apocalypto.
It is a shot-for-shot remake, so I encourage anyone to take a look at it.
It's neat. I actually kind of like Apocalypto.
Really?
Yeah.
I've still never seen it.
It's not unlike Passion of the Christ in that there's very little language spoken that's understood. You know, they have people... First Nation languages being spoken as well. I don't know. I'm torn on it, but I appreciate effort made when a movie's kind of weird. So it's not torture porn like Passion of the Christ was. So that's good.
Well, so long as we're talking about better films, we should mention Terrence Malick's The New World, which is a much more accurate thing about the Pocahontas story. Also, interesting overlap, Christian Bale was in The New World, and he was in Pocahontas, so...
He was.
Oh, he was the young guy,
yep,
right?
He was.
Which is, what, 2 years after he was Jason Bateman?
This was like 5 years before he was Patrick Bateman in American Psycho.
Patrick Bateman.
Yeah.
Jason Bateman's a person.
Yeah, he is, yes.
Also, John Candy was originally supposed to be in Pocahontas, but after he died, his character was cut out of the film. And the film was also criticized for the fact that Russell Means was in the cast. He was the chief. Now, he was most famous at the time as a part-time actor. I think he'd been in Natural Born Killers as well. But he was famous for his activism in the 70s, and he was present at the Wounded Knee incident.
Oh, no shit.
Yep.
Good what? For him. That's where someone tripped and fell, right?
Yes. Slow news day, too, so it was all over.
Yeah.
So they actually used Native Americans, though, for the main parts.
Well, for the supporting role, yes, Russell Means.
Good for them.
Yeah. I'm
trying to remember who voiced Pocahontas.
I'm looking her up right now. It's
I think she was like someone they found for this, right? Like she was a minor actress before
Irene
this.
Irene Bedard, born in Alaska. Hmm. She's been in a lot of things, but it's I don't recognize most of them.
And then she was sung by Judy Kuhn, who had done, like, Who Sings for Everyone.
She was in Turok, Sons of Stone.
Yeah, it wasn't a bad cast. I mean, it's got Linda Hunt in it, too, and Mel Gibson, like I said. Billy Connolly's in there.
Oh, yeah, that's right, he is.
Connolly! No, it was a good, I guess, to Daniel's earlier point, it shows how much of a tentpole they expected this to be. They've got a really good cast, and what should have been a solid story for Disney.
Huh.
But it was just so... I don't even know, like, traditional? Like, paint-by-numbers, almost. There was nothing interesting about it.
Oh, right? Yeah, no, that's exactly what it is. It was paint-by-numbers.
It was almost crazy.
Yeah, and, like... And all the little things that you expect, like the goofy sidekick that's a talking animal, like the raccoon and the...
Yeah, like I think that's why I don't like Mulan either, because it's basically the same story.
But even less than that, because at least, you know, Eddie Murphy is a character. You know, the raccoon and the hummingbird are essentially nothing, right? Like,
well, that...
it's not... They didn't even go as far as having, like...
a voice?
What's the fish? From Little Mermaid.
Flounder.
Like Flounder, who is a character who talks, right?
I think that one of those mute characters was who John Candy was supposed to be, or it was like they split his character into those two and kept them mute as like a tribute to him.
Oh, he would have been a great pug, that little dog.
Oh, yeah.
Zazu.
You know, John Cleese was supposed to be Zazu, or he was up in the running to be Zazu.
Hey, and the live-action one is going to be John Oliver, which I'm totally fine with.
Oh, that's going to be amazing.
I'm still confused how they're going to do it. Is it going to be like a Babe movie? where it's actual animals with CG mouths, or...
I think it's going to be like the Jon Favreau Jungle Book movie, where they're talking, but they don't actually move their mouths.
Oh, okay. That was not a bad movie.
It was an unnecessary movie, just like this Lion King is, frankly.
Oh, yes, yeah, I don't disagree. Jeez, yeah.
So Disney was stumbling a little bit, and...
just to back up a fraction of a second, okay. And you can cut this out, but the other day we were talking about the live-action Lion King and how unnecessary it was, and I, just on a whim, I was going to make like a social post of, you know, how unnecessary it is, and what's next, a live-action Winnie the Pooh, directed by Wes Anderson, and people dressed as the characters... And lo and behold, there is a live-action Winnie the Pooh in development.
Oh, God.
Is it going to be directed by Wes Anderson?
No, it is not, which I am a little bit sad about. But it wasn't Ethan Hawke. It was who was it? He was going to be in it.
I have no idea, so I have to let you hang out here, buddy.
The guy from AI. Who was the like
Jude Law?
Jude Law. Yeah, I think he was supposed to be in it.
I like Jude Law, man. But again, it doesn't need to be done. Like, I'm watching the new DuckTales, and luckily, David Tennant is doing just an amped up version of his own Scottish accent. He's not trying to do whatever 1970s cartoon or 1940s cartoon that the original Scrooge McDuck was, right?
Oh, he's fantastic. Yeah,
he is. So that's what I'm hoping, that like Jude Law does it and just does kind of a dopier version of his own English accent and doesn't go, oh, bother. You know, like doesn't go full like stroke victim on us.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Disney in this era or current era, I guess, is very good at the unnecessary live action film since Beauty and the Beast did all right. And
that was cool.
What was the one that kicked off this stuff?
Little Mermaid?
Must have been dressed. What now?
The Little Mermaid?
No, the live action.
It must have been the Jungle Book, right? The one that came out 4 years ago now?
Maybe. Mm. Yeah.
But that.
Still very unnecessary.
Get someone with charisma, man. I like Hermione Granger as much as the next guy, but she just couldn't sell anything she did in Beauty and the Beast.
And if it's going to be a shot for shot remake, what's the point? Where's the creativity? Where's the surprise?
Exactly. I'm with you. So, obviously, Disney was going in having bad press, and it was really getting to Eisner. Despite the fact that they had one of the top grossing films of the year, as well as one of the most popular TV shows on the air, that was Home Improvement. That was a Disney product. Eisner was becoming increasingly paranoid. Thank you for that.
I imagine that everything after his cocaine arrest, Disney had something to do with.
Oh, they owned him after that.
Yeah.
If you want a career after this, you are our bitch.
Katzenberg was also continuously dealing bad press to Eisner, basically to try and get Eisner to pay the contractually obligated overage payments that were owed. And Eisner was becoming so paranoid, he was monitoring staff calls to see if anybody was still talking to Katzenberg.
He's going down like Nixon.
That damn mouse.
Well, that's what I'm saying, man. Like, this is mafia shit. Like, he's got, like, his ear to the floor. He's looking for people. Right? Which to me is funny because, I mean, I get it. Disney is like the biggest company on earth. And we think of the iPhone as having power, man. But Disney owns like a third of everything. But like, it's funny to me because he's so paranoid about random bullshit. That's great. That's really great.
Well, it turns out he was correct. If Katzenberg was leaving to found a new department or a new company, that paranoia was well-founded.
Oh, yeah, totally. But it's not like he's exactly leading by example either. Right. You know, he also managed to piss Katzenberg off, one of the most powerful creative minds in Hollywood. It's just like when you listen to things about the parks, which we might get into later here. you know, he pissed off Spielberg so bad, Spielberg went to Universal Studios. Like, you're in Hollywood with people who, like, care about what their intellectual property. You don't – they can take the ball and go home, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. There's always a rival studio.
Yeah.
Well, also, other top executives like marketing chief Bob Levin were leaving the company, and Eisner had to deal with the continuing failure of Disneyland Paris. So he had some – there were some legitimate problems with the Disney company as well. So Eisner had to rehabilitate himself to a certain degree, and in an attempt to save face, Eisner made a deal to buy ABC for $19 billion.
Was that billion with a B?
Yes.
In mid-90s money, that's a lot of money.
Well, it's still part of the thing that they own, and it rehabilitated Eisner's image as an expert dealmaker.
Sure, why not?
One of the final big movies that we're going to discuss today is the release of Toy Story, which also happened the same year as Pocahontas, actually, 1995. Now, the history of Pixar is way too broad to get into on this episode, but it might make for a good future season. Stay tuned, everyone. In short, it was originally part of ILM, but George Lucas sold it to Steve Jobs after Howard the Duck bombed. A lot of the people who were involved in making Pixar movies had been involved in the making of The Brave Little Toaster.
I was going to say that I honestly did not realize that until we looked at the credits in it in when we did that for Myopia. Mm-hmm. And it makes a lot of sense. It's a character-driven plot instead of a story-driven plot, and it's still a fun movie.
Mm-hmm. Very depressing.
Surprisingly depressing.
Well, that's what I think works about it for me is it's not formulaic like Disney. It actually dealt with some pretty dark things, and so do Pixar movies.
And I don't know if you guys remember in Brave Little Toaster, during the happy-go-lucky frog pond scene where everyone's singing and dancing and doing all that, the Brave Little Toaster gets shoved off to a side. He sees a single rose, like, hidden under a tree somewhere. She's all by herself. She sees her reflection in the Brave Little Toaster's chrome. Thinks it's another rose and starts snuggling up to him, or her, or whoever it is. Mm-hmm. And when he explains, no, that's just a reflection, that's not another flower, the flower gets all sad and depressed, and then you see the petals fall off the flower.
And then it kills itself.
As it kills itself. And it's just a god-awfully depressing scene in what is ultimately a depressing movie.
Yeah. I mean, I watched Up recently and cried the whole time, so we're good.
Yeah.
We're fine.
Pixar is very adept at getting the emotions out, not just telling a story, but like the first half hour of WALL-E, there wasn't a word spoken.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
And it was arguably one of the best half hours of a Disney movie in the last couple of years.
Well, WALL-E is almost 10 years old at this point.
I guess that's true.
WALL-E.
And, what is it? The Up, yeah. The first 15 minutes of Up has everybody just crying.
Oh, yeah.
It's crushing. It's absolutely crushing.
It is so soul-crushing, and it's out of nowhere. You don't expect it when you first see that movie.
Yeah, that's rough.
It's ironic that we're talking about how edgy and adult Pixar movies are, because ironically, when Toy Story was in development, production was shut down for that very reason. The big draw initially was that it was going to be the first ever fully computer-animated film, so they recruited a lot of staff that way. But director John Lasseter was constantly getting feedback from Katzenberg on what to change, and eventually, when they showed Katzenberg the results, he hated them. He thought Woody had been stripped of all of his charm, and ironically, Lasseter was surprised by the feedback because he was basically doing what Disney had been telling him to do. So the film was shut down and only restarted 3 months later after the Pixar team resubmitted the script. Steve Jobs was the guy who kept the work funded while the production had been shut down by Disney. He wasn't involved on the creative sides with any of Pixar things. Jobs, who was still the CEO of Pixar at the time, keep in mind, was mostly involved with maintaining the relationship with Disney. And Jobs, in case you've forgotten, famously hated Michael Eisner.
Hmm. So at this point in Pixar's life, Disney was just the distributor, right?
Yes.
Okay, so they had independent creativity.
Correct.
Okay.
And that actually, we'll get into that later, but that became a huge problem for Pixar when Disney was trying to buy them. Jobs did not want to work with Eisner, so he walked away from the negotiations.
Hmm. It doesn't surprise me. If you compare Disney's pictures with Pixar's, Pixar's work for many audiences, whereas Disney's are definitely tailored for younger, especially younger girls, their whole princess mentality.
Exactly. Well, they're merchandise-driven as well. I mean, they had Little Mermaid merchandise and The Lion King. Merchandise making $1 billion. That's what they're really depending on. And actually, Pixar's stock went down after Up was released because nobody was buying any Up merchandise.
I believe that. I mean, Up and even WALL-E, they are fantastic films. But, I mean, they're not really made with merchandising in mind. Whereas something like Toy Story, you can sell all those toys.
Like the Cars movie that I can't bother.
Oh, God. The sequel? Jeez.
There's another one coming out, too.
Because it needs that. And was it Planes or Boats or something like that?
Planes.
Because that's what we need. Spin-offs of a mediocre movie.
Well, John, we've got one other piece of entertainment to talk about in this in this episode, and it's something we've been avoiding so far, but I know you've been anxious to get into, and that's the Disney Afternoon, their animation block.
Mm-hmm. Hardcore erotica?
Pardon?
I said their hardcore erotica?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Chip and Dale, the first Disney gay couple ever.
Chip and Dale. I mean, with a name like Chippendale, of course it's erotica.
So if you recall in an earlier episode, we talked about how Michael Eisner had made creating a television animation a priority for Disney because that was the background he'd been in. The first two shows were Gummy Bears, which we discussed, and The Wuzzles.
Oh, The Wuzzles. I remember The Wuzzles.
I remember The Wuzzles, too. That's a blast from the past, man.
That is going... No one talks about The Wuzzles anymore.
Well, it only ran for one season.
I mean, I'm sure I watched it for at least two seasons worth.
Yeah. 1985, here we go.
Wow.
Following those two shows, in 1987, DuckTales premiered.
There you go.
The show ran for 100 episodes and was the basis for Treasure of the Lost Land, which didn't really hold up, if I recall.
Oh. That's too bad.
Part of the thing that was getting set in this was the formula for Disney Afternoons, which is where they take an established character and take them into a more modern setting. For example, in 1989, Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers premiered, which was a revival of Chip and Dale modeled after Magnum P.I.
Yeah,
it sure was.
Chip was Indiana Jones. Dale was Magnum P.I. You're right.
But those shows had all debuted in syndication, so channels could buy them and air them whenever. It wasn't until 1990... that the Disney Afternoon lineup was officially born. It consisted of Rescue Rangers, Gummy Bears, DuckTales, and a new show, Tailspin.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah, I love Tailspin.
That was a problem with me, is when these were on, I remember seeing, like, certain episodes here and there. Like, I remember an episode of Tailspin where the bear almost got fired because he was basically illiterate and kept misspelling the skywriting.
Yeah.
But I don't really remember too much else about it.
Yeah, I remember that they were very your typical, I guess, half-hour standalone episodic kind of shows. But at some point, they all came out with quote-unquote movies that were three or four episodes strung together that were origin stories. So DuckTales... well, I don't know if DuckTales did it, but I know Tailspin did it, Darkwing Duck did it, Goof Troop did it,
mm-hmm.
and they were very dark films compared with the episodes. So, like, mm-hmm. Tailspin, it was all about the orphan kid. Kit? Was that
his name? I believe so. That sounds right.
How he finds Baloo the bear, and how the pirates literally lay waste to the town of... Cape Suzette. And so it's very, very dark, very violent compared to the normal shows.
Well, I don't remember any of that.
Now, the next season, one of the shows was canceled, and it was Gummy Bears.
Oh, Gummy Bears, too. Wow, I remember all this stuff.
Poor Gummy Bears.
Well, they replaced Gummy Bears with Darkwing Duck.
That's okay.
Let's get dangerous. Yeah.
Now, I always assumed going into it that that had been a parody of Batman the Animated Series, but they apparently debuted in the same year. Or Darkwing Duck may have even been a little before.
If I remember right, Darkwing Duck was a spin-off of DuckTales, right?
He appeared in DuckTales once, I believe. But it might have been in the build-up to the show coming out.
Could have been, yeah.
Yeah. That's funny, because I, like... That's one of those shows that I remember. And Launchpad is his sidekick, who's that's right. also in...
Oh, yes. Launchpad McQuarrie. Yeah. So the next season, unfortunately, DuckTales was out, and it was replaced with Goof Troop.
Yeah, I remember Goof Troop. I liked Goof Troop.
Goof Troop wasn't as good as DuckTales, in my opinion.
Loser.
Yeah, fuck you. It was okay. The movie was fun. The show was fun.
The Goofy movie was, if I remember it correctly, it was way better than the DuckTales movie. Let's be honest.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, that's not hard, but a Goofy movie is great. I just don't remember which actually came out first, it or the show. The movie or the show, but...
I think the show did.
The show came out in 1993.
Yeah, then it's the movie came later, I think.
Yeah. And it the movie did what the DuckTales show didn't, that it picked up on the point of the show, and that Goof Troop was all about the relationship between Goofy and his son. And they did a fantastic job in that movie of doing it, some very poignant moments. Whereas DuckTales was all about the adventure.
Sure, that's exactly right.
In later seasons, the Disney Afternoon would be joined by things like the Aladdin animated series.
Good.
The Timon and Pumbaa show to piggyback off The Lion King, and Gargoyles. Also, and this is one that I remembered, Bonkers. Does anybody else remember that?
I do.
Was that the cop?
No, it was like a weird yellow and black spotted thing with a tail, right?
I think he was a cop, yeah.
Really? What am I thinking of? Marsupilami? What was that Australian bullshit? Maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
Oh.
Tasmania?
Oh, yeah, that's a WB bullshit, ain't it?
Oh, that's WB, you're right, yeah.
So Disney, this all just entrenched how big the Disney brand was growing. These were all incredibly popular shows at the time that were appearing on major networks, as well as stuff like Home Improvement and the fact that Eisner had just bought ABC. It showed that Disney was still in a good place despite the Jaws theme playing in the background. Eisner felt like he was stumbling after Katzenberg left. His biggest problem was that he didn't have a second in command who could help him guide the company the way Katzenberg did. And now that Katzenberg was working with Steven Spielberg and David Geffen to build DreamWorks, they were in trouble. But he did have some ideas about who that second in command could be, which we'll get into on the next episode.
No... We must know now.
Do you really want to know? You'll have to tune in. or participate on the panel in your case.
Yeah, yeah, really.
All right, so thank you very much for joining us today, everyone. I've been Daniel, your lovely, articulate host, who never stumbles over words whatsoever. And we had on panel...
Hey, this was Nick, who just realized he had muted himself for the last 90 seconds, so trust me, I was funny to me.
And this is John.
All right, well, thank you both very much for joining me, and thank you to all the listeners out there for taking a listen. I hope you'll join us next time as we go further into the history of the Disney Renaissance. Thanks, guys.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.